Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Kimberly Sandberg on behalf of Charles Eubanks. I would like to reserve several minutes of my time for rebuttal. I will keep my eye on the clock. At Mr. Eubanks' trial, the one eyewitness to this crime testified that it was Troy Jackson who did the crime. Troy Jackson is the one who did the stabbings. She also testified that Troy Jackson is the person who had the knife in his hand and that she didn't see Charles Eubanks holding a knife. In fact, she testified that she saw Charles Eubanks just standing there. In addition to that, the forensic evidence available to the state suggests it implicates Troy Jackson, but does not implicate Charles Eubanks. But the state nonetheless put a case together, and their case consisted largely of the testimony of confidential informants, jailhouse informants, who testified that Eubanks confessed to them while in jail, and the testimony of co-defendants who pointed the finger at Eubanks as the person who did the murder, and they also all took plea deals before testifying. And Charles Eubanks was convicted. But what the jury didn't hear was numerous points of impeachment evidence concerning these jailhouse informants and the co-defendants.
So, counsel, it seemed that there was cross-examination at trial that brought out the criminal records of the informants who were testifying, and also whether they were receiving any benefit for their testimony. So what more was needed to impeach them, and how could that have helped your client?
Well, for some of these witnesses, there were benefits that just weren't explored because they weren't disclosed. And for other of these witnesses were long-term confidential informants, sometimes paid confidential informants. That information was not disclosed to the defense. And so that really precluded the defense from engaging in a robust cross-examination for each and every one of those witnesses on what was their motivation for testifying, whether it was an expectation of a benefit, or just that the witness had a longstanding quid pro quo type relationship with law enforcement, where even if a benefit wasn't promised to them explicitly, that witness knew that if they testify, every time they testify, every time they help the state or law enforcement, they get something out of it. Although defense counsel was able to ask them, well, you have a lot of felony convictions, that's not the same as being able to engage in a robust cross-examination about, for example, you know, you were a confidential informant in this year and a confidential informant in this year. And, you know, what did you get for that in terms of your own criminal record or your own criminal plea deal? And the same thing is true of the expected benefits. If defense counsel had been able to really impeach and break down the credibility of each of these witnesses, it really would have changed the face of this prosecution. And we know how important these witnesses are by looking at the state's closing argument. So the state's closing argument focuses like 80%, I would say, on the testimony of these jailhouse informants and on the testimony of the co-defendants.
They have the testimony of the co-defendants, they have the informants, and who say that Mr. Eubank confessed multiple times to having committed the murder. And they have the testimony of one of the victims who survived. They have the physical evidence that was retrieved from a burn pit. So there was more than just these confidential informants. It was pretty strong evidence.
Your Honor, I would argue against the idea that there was strong evidence. The evidence found in the burn pit did not implicate Mr. Eubanks. Now, certainly there was evidence of...
But didn't he say that they burned things in the backyard?
Yes.
He confessed to doing that?
Yes. So there was certainly...
shoes, and he was arrested while he was barefoot. And, I mean, there was... there was a fair amount to link them to whatever they were destroying in the burn pit.
Well, there was evidence that he certainly helped burn things. I mean, that's irrefutable evidence that he was helping destroy evidence. And in fact, that was, you know, one of the crimes that he was willing to plead guilty to is accessory after the fact. But I would argue that there was not strong evidence that he actually committed the murder or aided and abetted in committing the murder. The one eyewitness who is a victim to this crime said that he didn't, said that he just stood there, he didn't have a knife, and he didn't do the stabbing. In fact, she said Troy Jackson stabbed Frazier, then stabbed her and stabbed Frazier again. And the evidence recovered from the burn pit shows that Troy Jackson's DNA is on one of the knives. None of Eubanks' DNA was found in any of that. And the evidence shows that Michael Frazier, the murder victim, his DNA and blood was found in the part of the car that Troy Jackson was sitting in the part of the white van that was used to transport. The murder victim's blood was found where he was sitting, but not where Charles Eubanks was sitting. So I would argue that there was not strong evidence, which is why the state put together a case that consisted of jailhouse informants with long criminal records and the testimony of the co-defendants. Your Honors, I would just like to talk about the closing argument again and point out how many times the state talked about these various witnesses, the ones that, you know, all of the impeachment evidence wasn't turned over by the state. During their closing argument, the state talked about Danny Jarvis's testimony at least 7 times. The state talked about Charisma Garcia's testimony at least 6 times. Kaufman's testimony.
We had something like 8 people testify, right? And they all corroborated, some of it corroborated the other testimony. And
yeah,
they were all impeached when they testified for their criminal histories. They were all questioned about benefits they were receiving. They included Mr. Eubanks' girlfriend, plus the co-defendants, plus people he, according to their testimony, he told that he committed the murder while he was in jail. So this seems like pretty strong evidence. And the fact that the prosecution is mentioning that these witnesses testified, I'm not really seeing how that compounds some sort of prejudice for your client.
The prejudice comes from the fact that defense counsel was not able to say to, for example, Danny Jarvis, you've been an informant in the past. When you were an informant and you testified for the state or you helped law enforcement, you got something out of that. Right.
So how is, I guess that seems that it's not, well, it's at least not clear to me how that's entirely relevant if he to the particular testimony at issue in this trial.
Well, it would be relevant because if Danny Jarvis is being asked to testify he against Mr. Eubanks, he knows that his testimony, you know, the expected testimony.
So you're thinking it's some sort of implied agreement that he's going to receive a benefit and that that is what they would be able to establish through cross if they'd had some more disclosure?
That's correct. And in fact, for specifically just taking the witness, Danny Jarvis, who's just one example, you know, a month after he testified, the prosecutor in Eubanks' case actually attended Danny Jarvis's sentencing hearing and then testified for Danny Jarvis and explained to the court that Danny Jarvis's testimony was very helpful in Charles Eubanks' trial. And
didn't they know that? I thought they knew that there was no agreement that Jarvis would get anything in specific, but that they would report that he had cooperated. And I thought that was disclosed, that there was just something more you wanted, that the defense is arguing should have been disclosed.
Your Honor, I believe that would be Andrew Kaufman, who testified that he was hoping to get something and then, in fact, did get quite a deal of a 50% reduction in his federal sentence for gun charges. But Danny Jarvis testified that he was getting nothing from his testimony. In fact, he testified that he was coming forward because it was the right thing to do. He didn't, you know, there was no disclosure that not only did he receive a benefit of his brother's murder investigation being reopened for sending this information to the district attorney, but there was no disclosure that the prosecutor, the person prosecuting Charles Eubanks, would then be attending Jarvis's sentencing hearing and testifying on Jarvis's behalf at his sentencing hearing. None of that was disclosed. And these are the kinds of disclosures that had defense counsel had had and had the jury heard over and over and over again. Each one of these state's witnesses be impeached with this kind of evidence, it really would have changed the face of this prosecution, because given the one eyewitness and victim testimony and the lack of forensic evidence, this is really what the state's case rested on. It was on these alleged confessions of Eubanks to jailhouse informants and on the co-defendants who pointed the finger and said, Eubanks did the murder, not Troy Jackson. Your Honors, if there are no other questions at this time, I would ask to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Senior Deputy Jamie Stills on behalf of Respondent Appley in this matter. Respondent asked this court to affirm the decisions of the state and district courts and find that Eubanks is not entitled to habeas relief. Eubanks is not entitled to habeas relief for four main reasons. First, the Nevada Supreme Court correctly rejected his claim in ground 5-3, which decision is entitled to deference. Second, the district court correctly rejected his claim in ground 5-7 due to lack of prejudice. Third, the district court correctly held Eubanks failed to satisfy Martinez to overcome the procedural default of ground 5-9. Finally, the Nevada Supreme Court correctly rejected ground 6C3, which decision is also entitled to deference. Now, unless there are any other questions at this time, I'd like to take these claims a little bit out of order. I'd like to start with ground 5-9, then move to ground 6C3, then come back to grounds 5-3 and 5-7. On ground 5-9, the district court correctly determined Eubanks failed to satisfy Martinez to overcome procedural default because trial counsel was not deficient regarding conveying plea offers and counteroffers.
Can you turn to the claim with respect to the alleged Brady violation?
Absolutely, Your Honor. So with respect to Brady, the Nevada Supreme Court correctly determined that Eubanks failed to establish any cumulative impact of the alleged Brady material, such that it impacted his trial outcome. So as an initial matter, this claim isn't properly before the court because Eubanks failed to properly raise it in his federal habeas petition. But more importantly, there's no merit to this claim. Brady.
Didn't he raise it sort of a general, an argument of there's generally cumulative error, and wouldn't it be proper for the district court to have narrowed that and considered certifying the question on cumulative error with respect to the Brady claims?
The presentation of a general cumulative error claim doesn't really meet, at least in respondent's opinion, doesn't really meet proper party presentation under Clark v. Sweeney. So respondent's position is a general claim isn't sufficient to alert respondent about the need to address the specific cumulative error of Brady, which requires a more in-depth focus rather than a general cumulative error claim.
So just assuming for our discussion this morning that we don't agree with that, can you address the claim, assuming we're going to reach these Brady claims?
Absolutely, Your Honor. So as I was saying, there isn't any merit to this claim. So as this court is aware, there are three components to Brady. The one at issue before the court is materiality. And the standard for materiality is a reasonable probability of a different outcome, not just a reasonable possibility, but a reasonable probability. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court has held that non-disclosure of impeachment evidence, even if it would result in witnesses being severely impeached or testimony excluded entirely, it still doesn't amount to a material Brady violation if other evidence provides strong support for conviction. Additionally, this court has specified that when it comes to impeachment evidence, there's no materiality if the suppressed evidence merely adds on to already impeached witnesses. So here, there's simply no materiality to any of the different components of Brady violations that Eubanks is alleging. With respect to the alleged jailhouse benefit, informant benefits evidence, specifically with Jarvis, there's no evidence of any understandings. So Eubanks talks about how the DA testified at Jarvis's sentencing hearing after the trial in Eubanks's case. There is no requirement or restriction prohibiting the district attorney from rewarding a witness after trial takes place. And Jarvis testified, and the DA testified, that there was no understandings or promises or expectations at the time of the testimony at Eubanks' trial. Additionally, Jarvis was already impeached on his credibility by testifying that he was a multiple-time convicted felon, that he was currently incarcerated, that he knew Frazier for over 5 years, that Frazier paid for his girlfriend's rent, that he and the district attorney's office had rehearsed his testimony, that he waited to tell the DA regarding Eubanks's statements to him, and that he had spoken to Charisma Garcia before. With respect to Kaufman, there's no evidence of any promises that the federal prosecutor or the state prosecutor were going to file a 35B motion. What Kaufman testified to was that he was hoping, and he had an agreement with the state prosecutor's office, that the state prosecutor's office would send a letter to the federal prosecutor, and hopefully the federal prosecutor would file something like a motion that would result in a sentence reduction. So Eubanks was already fully aware, and the jury was already fully aware, of the understanding and agreement between Kaufman and the district attorney's office. Additionally, Kaufman was already impeached on other aspects of his credibility. For instance, he testified that he was currently incarcerated, that he was a convicted felon, and that he met with the district attorney's office to rehearse his testimony. Moving on to the informant evidence. Again, there is no materiality here. With respect to Charisma Garcia, her credibility was already impeached because she testified that she was a multiple-time convicted felon, that she had a plea agreement with other cases, that she was really nervous, that she was currently incarcerated, that she couldn't remember when she spoke with Eubanks, that she waited to tell the DA about Eubanks, that she barely knew Eubanks, and yet he confessed all this material to her, that she previously worked with law enforcement, and that she had access to Eubanks' discovery. With respect to Jackson, his credibility was already obviously impeached because of his participation in the crimes. Additionally, he testified that he was a multiple-time convicted felon, that he had a plea agreement with the state, that he lied at both his deposition and at the preliminary hearings, and that he was used to manipulating people. With respect to Victoria Garcia, again, her credibility was impeached because of her participations in the crime. She was additionally impeached by testifying that she was a convicted felon, that she lied to detectives, that she knew Frazier for over 15 years and thought he was a wonderful guy, that she had a plea agreement and worked with the prosecution on her testimony, that she was Jackson's girlfriend and obviously wanted him to have less culpability than Eubanks, and that she said at her deposition that Eubanks would be an easy target to avoid responsibility. There's also no materiality to the alleged conflicts of evidence, of interest evidence regarding Counsel Butel, who represented Victoria Garcia and Jarvis, or for Counsel Yorger, who represented at various times Charisma Garcia, Dowling, and Antoinette. There's pure speculation on Eubanks' behalf that any attorney representation overlap had any bearing on these witnesses. Even if this court were to find that there could have been some sort of conflict of interest, all of these witnesses were already impeached. We already covered some of them. Going to Dowling, who we haven't covered yet, his credibility was impeached by his testimony that he was a multiple-time convicted felon, that he couldn't recall when the conversations with Eubanks occurred, that he knew Frazier, that he had a plea deal with the district attorney's office, and that he had a plea deal with the district attorney's office for a substantial sentence reduction. Lastly, there's no materiality to the alleged pretrial contact. Again, it's pure speculation that any type of collaboration occurred. Moreover, again, we've covered that the credibility was already impeached for most of these witnesses. We haven't covered Maxwell and Rubio. So looking at Maxwell, his credibility was already impeached because he testified that he was a convicted felon, Obviously, he also participated in the crimes to some degree. He also testified that he took a plea deal, that he wasn't happy about being in prison, that he liked detectives, and that he was hoping that his wife could have a special deal by virtue of his participation. With respect to Rubio, again, she participated in the crimes as well, and her credibility was also impeached by her testimony that she was a convicted felon, that she was a meth addict, that she had a plea agreement, that her memory was not as good, and that she lied to detectives. Ultimately, Eubanks admits the only purpose of all this purported Brady evidence is just for impeachment of witness credibility. But there are two problems with that. The first problem, of course, is that there's substantial evidence that supports Eubanks' conviction. The other problem is that cumulative impeachment evidence doesn't rise to the level of materiality under Brady because they were already impeached to various degrees pretty substantially for every single one of these witnesses. Therefore, the Nevada Supreme Court and the district court correctly determined that this claim lacks merit. Moving to ground 5-9, the district court correctly determined Eubanks failed to satisfy Martinez to overcome procedural default because counsel was not deficient with respect to conveying plea offers and counteroffers. Under AEDPA, district courts can't consider new evidence that petitioners failed to develop in state court. Last year, this court reiterated that if a prisoner fails to present new evidence to state courts in compliance with state procedural rules, that's a failure to develop the factual basis of the claim, and the evidence must be precluded.
So here, your argument is that Eubank is relying on a couple of letters that were not presented to the state court.
Correct, Your Honor. Eubanks is relying on these two letters from April 2012 that he purportedly received from his counsel. Obviously, he received these letters way before his first state habeas petition in 2015. He had these letters in his possession for years, and there was simply no reason he couldn't have attached them to his first state habeas petition at minimum. He also didn't even raise this claim in his first state habeas petition, but he could have at minimum attached the letters and made some indication that he wanted to develop that into something further. He failed to do so. Eubanks cites to the Rodney case in his reply brief, but Rodney is completely an opposite here. In Rodney, the petitioner's claims all hinged on the victim's medical records, which the pro se prisoner petitioner had virtually no shot at obtaining without the assistance of counsel. Again, here, Eubanks actually had these letters. They were in his possession. There was no reason for him not to attach them to his first state habeas petition. So Rodney is completely an opposite. The more pertinent cases, of course, are the Hampton v. Shin case, McLaughlin v. Oliver, and Bayerano v. Rubart, where this court said over and over and over again, you have to develop your claims and your evidence in state court in compliance with procedural rules. And Eubanks simply failed to do that.
And then I assume your argument is also that even if the letters were properly presented, they don't substantiate the claim.
That's correct, Your Honor. So he fails to show deficient performance and prejudice even with those letters. Eubanks' original plea deal was for robbery with use of a deadly weapon, but he rejected that plea deal and said he wanted to go to trial.
Is there any evidence? I know this touches on a different issue with respect to ineffective assistance of counsel with the elements of the crimes, but what is the evidence, if any, that he was willing to take a plea deal?
There's really not any evidence that he was willing to take a plea deal. He said over and over and over again that he did not want to take a plea. So trial counsel originally worked out a plea deal with the state regarding taking a robbery with use of a deadly weapon charge and pleading guilty to that. That obviously would have been an extremely favorable deal. But Eubanks rejected that deal in open court against counsel's advice. It was on the record that counsel said, I'm advising him to take this, and Eubanks is rejecting this. Eubanks advised counsel over and over again that he did not want to take a plea deal, that he wanted to take this to court. Moreover, he also said to various witnesses in jail that he wanted to take this case to the box, that he wanted to take this all the way to trial. He thought he could beat this case. Additionally, at sentencing, he didn't say anything about wanting to take a plea deal or misunderstanding anything. What he said was, I wanted to take this case to trial. I wanted to put this case before a jury. So there's really no evidence that Eubanks would have accepted a plea deal unless perhaps it was a plea deal for accessory to murder and attempt accessory to murder, which the prosecution basically said there's no way on earth that we will allow him to take that plea deal. We will not give him anything that low. So there's simply no merit that counsel performed deficiently or that there's any prejudice because Eubanks simply would not take a deal and the prosecution would not accept the only offer that Eubanks was willing to confer. With respect to ground 5-3, the Nevada Supreme Court correctly determined trial counsel performed effectively and Eubanks failed to establish deficient performance or prejudice. There is no likelihood of a different result with respect to the aiding and abetting liability, and there's no evidence that counsel failed to even explain that in the first place. With respect to ground 5-7, the district court correctly determined that Eubanks can't demonstrate prejudice regarding the corrected attempt robbery sentence. As an initial matter, Eubanks already received the benefit of a corrected attempt robbery sentence, so that should end the inquiry right there. Moreover, Eubanks
can't... Is his position that because of the error, the undisputed error, that it should have been remanded for resentencing in its entirety?
His position appears to be that he should have received the corrected sentence at the time of the sentencing hearing, as well as receive a new sentencing hearing. So there seems to be two different components. Obviously, he already received the benefit of the corrected sentence. So that component takes out that argument that he's making.
So if he could have a new sentencing hearing, potentially he could receive a different sentence, which would mean that the error may have caused some prejudice.
Your Honor, I see I'm about to be out of time. May I briefly respond? So he would not have received, he might not have received a new sentencing hearing, and even if he did, it wouldn't have changed anything. So if trial counsel had objected, there wouldn't have been a new sentencing hearing because he was already in the sentencing hearing. If appellate counsel had objected, the Nevada Supreme Court could have simply ordered the state district court to correct the sentence because the state courts have the inherent power to issue an amended JOC at any time to correct an improper sentence. Even if the Nevada Supreme Court, though, had remanded it for a new sentencing hearing, there's no evidence that there would have been a different result because Eubanks already had an extensive sentencing hearing, and at that sentencing hearing, he argued for a reduced sentence on the attempt robbery charge. The prosecution argued for the maximum. Parole and probation stated then in the PSI that Eubanks should receive a 40 to 180-month sentence, which is the source of the error because they quoted the maximum for robbery rather than attempt robbery. And the court agreed that Eubanks should receive the maximum sentence possible for attempt robbery. The court simply got confused about what that maximum was. But when the court learned of the error, the court agreed that Eubanks should still have that maximum sentence possible. And therefore, even if he had received a new sentencing hearing, there was no likelihood of a different result. Accordingly, and for the foregoing reasons, respondents ask this court to affirm. Thank you, Your Honors.
Your Honors, I would just like to make two main points in my rebuttal. The first one goes to the Brady claim. If there was such strong evidence against Eubanks, or even if there was good evidence against Eubanks, the state would not have needed to tap the testimony of jailhouse informants and confidential informants to come in and testify that Eubanks allegedly confessed to them. The fact is the state's case depended on these witnesses where the victim and eyewitness to the crime said Eubanks didn't do it, and the forensic evidence did not implicate Mr. Eubanks. Eubanks should have been afforded the opportunity to show the jury why these witnesses were testifying the way they were. In other words, what did they hope to gain from their testifying the way that they testified? And if he had been able to do that, it really would have changed the face of the prosecution, and there is a reasonable probability of a different outcome at this trial. And then my second point that I would like to make is just that as far as the IAC claim, the Martinez claim, Rodney V. Garrett is the appropriate case here. Eubanks was pro se during his state habeas proceedings. He was diligent in attempting to develop the state court record.
It doesn't have to be diligent with respect to each individual claim. It's not just general diligence.
Your Honor, it's not even clear that he had his file at the time. During his direct appeal, he filed a motion asking the court for his discovery and file, complaining that he didn't have any of that. And so he was diligent. He couldn't, in other words, raise a claim if he doesn't have the information. And as a pro se litigant, he was unable to raise the claim and unable to develop the state court record because he asked for an evidentiary hearing and for counsel to be appointed numerous times, and the state court just didn't appoint counsel and did not hold an evidentiary hearing. Had that been done and post-conviction counsel had been appointed and had gathered all of the files as, you know, we do, then the claim would have been apparent. But it wasn't because he was a pro se litigant trying to litigate his state post-conviction petition on his own.
But the claim is that counsel didn't properly convey plea agreements, and it's based on his communications with counsel and letters he received. So it's not clear to me how he didn't know about this.
It's possible that I'm sure at some point he knew that he had received many plea offers throughout this case, but I think expecting a pro se litigant to remember every single time a plea offer was made or not made, or a plea, you know, like his offers to the DA were not made, is not reasonable. That's why
Is there any evidence that he would have accepted a plea? It seems there's a fair amount of evidence that he had no interest in a plea bargain and he wanted to go to trial, and that he said so.
The evidence that he would have considered a plea is in his state post-conviction petition. That's the evidence that he would have accepted a plea. He states in his pro se state post-conviction petition that he would have accepted a plea, not on this claim, on the aiding and abetting claim. But as far as this claim, obviously that evidence isn't there because the claim wasn't raised.
Thank you.
I just asked this court to reverse the lower court's decision and grant the writ. Thank you.
Counsel, thank you both for your arguments this morning. They were helpful. And this case is submitted.